Today, is this going to do something or not? Yeah.
Okay. Try to get to the core of Kant's perpetual peace today, and that is his preliminary articles. Remember, he separates the document, his definitive articles. He separates the document into preliminary articles and definitive articles. Preliminary articles are the steps that he believes could have been taken in his own generation to move in the direction of perpetual peace, recognizing that the project for ending war is not a project for a single generation to accomplish. It's something that must happen over time. And so each generation can, the implication is every generation is in a position to draw up its own set of preliminary articles, you know, things that it could do to move in the direction of perpetual peace.
Well, I'm just wondering how possible it is for some of these articles to come to fruition if a lot of what he's talking about is in the mindset of beginning of industrialization, and we're somewhat past it into an information age somewhat. So I'm wondering how much of this stuff is still
relevant
today.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question, of course. Kant is I wouldn't. A lot of people think that we're in a post-industrial society. I personally don't. You know, I think that we are still in a very advanced industrial society, but the so-called information age is only really productive insofar as it's plugged into the stuff that actually transforms the natural world in such a fashion that it's usable. That doesn't mean that cultural products like, you know, films and stuff that we're going to see in the gallery and so forth are unimportant. But after all, people have to be able to eat, they have to be able to shelter themselves and so forth. And globally, it's kind of a mix what's happening. I mean, China is beginning, if not the early stages of its industrial revolution, certainly not an advanced stage. You know, most people who work in Chinese factories still work assembly line style. They put in long, hard days, that sort of thing. But nonetheless, you're absolutely right that we live in a much different period than Kant did. But the way I look at it is that we live at in the latter part of the period that Kant began to write about. And like a number of people, he was incredibly prescient. You know, he saw what was coming. He saw two things that were coming, one of which he regarded as a progressive step. And we'll talk about that in the context of the definitive articles, because it's the first of his definitive articles, namely that peace is possible provided that republics spread across the face of the earth. See, what Kant recommends is the widespread adoption of republican government by societies. And that's happened since Kant died. And that's one of the great political stories since Kant died. You know, there are some monarchies left, but they're pretty much monarchies in name only. Even countries whose republican status might be challenged call themselves republics. You know, there's the Islamic Republic of Iran. There is there were the People's Republics of the East Bloc countries and so forth. So the idea of republican government has become very well established since Kant died. The other thing that he foresaw, and he was living at a period in which industrialization was just beginning. You were getting the introduction of explosive weaponry into the battlefield. And Napoleon's army wasn't exactly pre-industrial, for example. What he began to foresee was the application of technology to war and the impact of that in terms of the massive destructiveness of war. So even though he's living at the tail end of the 18th century, what he says, I think, has some reach. Now, that doesn't mean that every little bit and piece of Kant's proposal is workable. It doesn't even mean that the proposal is workable at all. I mean, that's something for us to look at and to decide. But I do think it means that Kant's position is still relevant. And it certainly was thought to be relevant after the First World War when the League of Nations was created, after the Second World War, when the United Nations was created, and even now, when there's a move to reform UN institutions, and people are reading Kant and thinking about perpetual peace and thinking about exactly what it means institutionally. But let's just take a look at the preliminary articles. You know, the first one, as I said, is that republics need to spread across the face of the globe. Kant believes that republican government itself contributes to peace. that republics are far less likely to go to war than, for example, monarchies. Why is that? What's his reasoning behind that? Somebody else? Can somebody else say something about this? Yes?
Because people won't necessarily consent to war. Like, they're not, you know, if they have a say, they're not going to want to go off to die for someone, for a leader that's not even involved necessarily.
Yeah, excellent. Go ahead.
I was reading something. I think it was that article on terrorism that was up before. I don't think it's still on the syllabus, but with Habermas.
Oh, yes, Habermas and Derrida.
One of them was saying something about democracies necessarily demonizing their enemies.
Yeah. And I think this is a widespread recognition now, and to me it seems basically true. The idea is this. Kant argues that citizens of republics are not likely to want to go to war for exactly the reason you gave. A king can send his armies into the field and sit back in his palace, especially in the 18th century, when to be defeated in war did not mean to be hung. You know, it didn't mean to be, you know, at the very worst, when Napoleon was defeated by the British, he was exiled to an island off the coast of Italy. That's where I want to retire, for God's sake. You know, I wish I could be exiled to an island off the coast of Italy. So it was possible in those days for monarchs, for heads of government, to fight wars, although Napoleon himself went into the field. But to fight wars, to stay home, and not to really suffer very many of the consequences that their citizens suffered, who had to fight and die, who had their farms interfered with by enemy armies, that kind of thing. So what Kant reasons is that when you have a form of government that rests on the consent of the governed, in which public opinion is significant, then the likelihood of going to war is going to be far less, because the people themselves who are going to suffer, the people themselves whose agreement has to be won to go to war are the primary people who are going to suffer as a result of war. Yes?
I'm sorry to say that. What about North Korea? What role do you play in? Is it the leader is playing monarchy?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, once again, you have the People's Republic of North Korea, right? Or the People's Republic of Korea.
Yes.
But what exactly the government is another question. You know, is the North Korean government a genuine republic? I mean, for that matter, is the United States government a genuine republic? There was an ideal of republican government that inspired the American Revolution and the French Revolution and a number of movements across the world. But that ideal was the ideal of a society in which the consent of the governed is critical to the process of governing. But how much consent did the U.S. government really need to garner in order to go to war in the Gulf or the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan and so forth? How much consent did Congress even give? Let me put it this way. How much informed consent on the model of the Constitution did Congress give?
I suppose so, but I guess if you think about it that way, I remember there was some issue at the very beginning of the revolution. A lot of the bills that were being, like, especially the Declaration of Independence, they were only given a few days to read it. So a lot of them, they kept postponing it because they didn't have a chance to read it. So that's one of the very real vulnerabilities I see in the Republican government, is that if you want people to be informed, you're going to have them full-time on these jobs, reading stuff every day. But the fact is that these are only part-time positions. These aren't full-time jobs. And
what are only part-time
positions? Well, I'm talking about the Senate. A lot of times senators may have other jobs besides just being senators or in the House. I guess my point
is, not really. I mean, a senator or a congress or a congressional member of the House is paid quite well for doing that job.
Generally a for life position unless they're, you know, deposed.
In many cases, yeah.
I guess my point is that a lot of these people, they don't always get a chance to completely understand what is going on.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to have to the Constitution kind of government if not everybody voting on these things are completely informed.
Yeah. Well, this is a problem. It may be an endemic problem with Republicans. I mean, the theory is that voting shall be informed voting, not just by representatives, but by people who elect representatives.
Right.
And so that was the reason why the notion of a well-developed public sphere was important, always important to republics. So that in the colonial period, you know, it was the tavern, it was the small-scale newspaper. Now what we have, of course, is mass media, which is quite different, you know, which is really sort of manipulative in character. Well, in any event, the argument that Kant makes is that it's less likely for republics to get the consent of their citizens to go to war. But, as some people have pointed out, as many people have pointed out, this has actually raised it's actually led to the process that James is calling the demonization of the enemy. Because if the citizen body is reluctant to go to war for ordinary purposes, right, and to expand the influence of a king, or to regain some territory that was lost in a previous war. If citizens are reluctant to go to war for limited purposes, then the only thing that motivates them to go to war is the idea that they are fighting the devil himself. So you don't just go to war against Saddam Hussein, you go to war against the axis of evil, or the greatest dictator since Hitler. You don't just go to war against the United States, but you go to war against the great Satan. And that's, of course, the language of the Iranian Republic, the great Satan. And so what happens is that when the enemy is demonized, there is only one outcome that makes sense. It's no longer the winning of limited goals that followed by peace treaties that leave both governments and power and so forth, as was the standard in the 18th century, it's now the annihilation of the enemy. In other words, the only kind of war against a demonized enemy that makes sense is total war.
Sometimes going to war can be brainwashed. Like, the reason why you're going to war is because for your freedom, you know? You don't want your kids, your next generation to be slaves, you know, so that motivates you, you going to war. But it can be false, you know, by telling you, because you want, some people going to war because of the purpose. But
because of the what?
Because of something you want to achieve by going to war, or it can be freedom.
Sure, sure. And I mean, that's a classical reason to go to war. It's a classical reason to oppose an aggressor, right? You're defending your freedom. But in the modern period, with the demonization of the enemy, it's not just that you're defending your freedom. It's that if the enemy wins, everything is over. You know, it's as though, you know, if... Yeah, go ahead, James.
This is going back again, but Mr. Hobsbawm, in this article on
barbarism,
was pointing out that when the United States went to war with Iraq, you know, we talked a lot about how he was a genocidal dictator. But in fact, in the 1980s, American businessmen and weapons manufacturers were selling him weapons, the very chemical weapons he used to mass murder Kurds.
There was a professor in the economics department, Art McEwen, whose office was directly across from mine, and during the first Gulf War, during the Iraq War, he had a cartoon on his door, and the cartoon had George Bush being questioned by the press. And the press asks him, you know, how do you know that Saddam Hussein possesses weapons of mass destruction? And Bush says, we kept the receipts. Yeah, well, I mean, Saddam Hussein was the U.S.'s surrogate in an attempt to control Iran.
The irony of this is that a lot of the chemical weapons we sold them that actually buried in the desert for fear of our finding them again.
In any event, but you get the idea, right? That in a kind of perverse way, the fact that the principle of government by consent in a kind of perverse way has raised the stakes and the destructiveness of war.
The interesting thing is it reminds me of the argument that people made for the right for slavery, the religious argument that God is watching on your actions. The only way to enslave somebody is if they're not really a person, kind of idea. So it's a similar argument I've seen with war, is that if someone is against you, if you demonize them to the point where they're not really human, they're some sort of great demon, that it's okay to kill them and it's okay to take their property. So it's just a similar idea of desensitization.
Sure. And what Hobsbawm points out in his article on Barbarism, a User's Guide, you should definitely read that if you haven't already. The Barbarism, a User's Guide, Hobsbawm is a British historian who's written a whole series of works, but probably his most famous is his most recent history, and it's called The Age of Extremes, a history of the short 20th century. Now, Hobsbawm claims that as historical units, centuries don't necessarily begin at the year one and then end in 99, right? For Hobsbawm, the 20th century as a meaningful historical unit begins in 1914, and it ends in 1989. Why 1914? What happens in 1914?
World War I.
Yeah, World War I breaks out, right? What happens in 1989? The fall of the East Bloc nations, right? The East Bloc nations. So the beginning of the modern, or the 20th century, the period of the 20th century, is the initiation of the most destructive war that had happened in history to that point. Remember, 10 million people were killed in World War I. It was unprecedented. The number of deaths were absolutely unprecedented. We'll talk about this more next time, but the point that Hobsbawm makes is that the period leading up to World War I was actually a period of relative progress, especially if you look at Europe, the European continent. Wars became less frequent over the course of the 19th century. They involved fewer parties to disputes. They were, in many cases, prevented by diplomatic procedures that settled disputes before they broke out in the form of war. And there were also major attempts, and successful attempts, to control the destructiveness of war once it was launched. And here the classic example is the Geneva Conventions. Now, the Geneva Conventions made a distinction between citizens, unarmed citizens of the enemy nation, and armed soldiers. The only legitimate object of military assault is a soldier under arms, ready and willing to fight. It made the point that once a soldier abandons his arms and surrenders, then he now has the status of a civilian. He can't, with all the protections that a civilian has. He can, of course, be imprisoned in order to keep him from returning to his army and fighting against you. But once he's imprisoned, he should be accorded all of the rights and amenities that the soldiers on your own side are accorded. That became a widespread principle. Torture was banned as an instrument of state policy. An international organization was created to police the application of the Geneva Accords, the Red Cross, and so forth. And so it looked like the 19th century really was Kant's century, if you want to put it that way. Kant died in the early years of the 19th century, but the 100 years that followed Kant were represented both the expansion of republics and the taming of war. And then in 1914, everything comes to an end. And it doesn't just come to an end with a return to the status quo ante, the status quo before Kant died. It comes to an end with an unprecedented level of mass destruction.
I know this is the traditional position of devil's advocate here, but the 19th century...
You can drop the word advocate, James. You can drop the word advocate. I'm demonizing you now.
You wouldn't say that to the man with the Bible in his pocket.
That's true. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, yeah, I don't know, man. I could be a witch, but well, what I was going to say is just that you know, these laws of civility between nations were only really applicable if you were afforded them.
That's
between European nations, you know, certainly there were laws of civility.
Yeah.
But if you were to go into, say, the Belgian Congo, there would be no laws of civility. If you were to go into the Sudan, there would be no laws of civility. There was a violent uprising in the Sudan in the late 19th century.
Yes.
The Mahdi, well, the self-proclaimed Mahdi.
In other words, although martial relations between European states were calming down, colonial violence, the violence of colonizers
the colonized, certainly, and in response, the violence of the colonized against the colonizers.
Also,
when the Mahdi uprising came, you know, they just overpowered a weak colonial defense force. There was a British military hero there, General Gordon, and you know, in response, the British government left them alone for a while, and then came back with machine guns and murdered everyone.
Yeah, and also the 19th century, of course, was the century of the American destruction of the native population in the westward advance, especially in the period following the Civil War. Yeah.
I can't remember who the Clash of Civilizations.
It's kind
of
like Huntington.
The theory that we're no longer going to go to war with people who share our same sort of cultures and norms and morals. And one of the arguments is that's why we're fighting with people in the Middle East and not people in Europe.
Yeah, right. That warfare has now become a cultural context, a way of expressing it, a conflict between cultures. Yeah.
Reminds me of the Middle Ages with the religious wars between Protestants and Catholics, that ideas that were slightly different or basically clash of the religious wars between each other. It just reminds me of the scenario, even though it's culture instead of religion.
Yeah. What does?
Well, it's just that they're fighting over... maybe America and the Middle East Islamics.
Yeah, but that means that you have to take the ideology seriously. I mean, there's a certain way in which you do. You know, the U.S. says that it's fighting for, I don't know what, for democracy or liberty. The Islamists say that they're fighting against the occupying infidels and so forth. There's a difference between the justifications that nations give for war and the actual forces that lead nations to war. And I'm not at all sure that on either side, you know, there's honesty. You
know, that those are just the fronts that you don't really know their real reason.
Yeah. By the way, Kant is interesting. If you read, I forget which appendix it is, of Perpetual Peace, Kant has one of the most ringing indictments of European colonialism that can be read prior to the 19th century, and certainly prior to Marx and to philosophers that followed Marx. Kant, although he was a person of extremely conservative habits personally, and although he was basically a moderate liberal politically, was a doggedly anti-imperialist. And surprisingly, he condemns the Western treatment of Native Americans. He condemns the Western penetration of Asia and the beginnings of colonization of Asia. He condemns the African slave trade in ringing terms. And he says, you know, rhetorically, he says that the Europeans call the peoples that they colonize savages, but look at European behavior, I mean, isn't it the Europeans who are the savages? And to say this in the late 18th century was an extremely unusual position to take.
Were there other people who shared his views widespread, or were they just him?
It was not widespread. I wouldn't say that it was non-existent. As a matter of fact, what's interesting about Kant is that Kant was essentially a moderate liberal. So by liberal, what I mean is somebody who places a premium on liberty. That's what liberalism in its classical sense means. That the primary virtue of social life is the protection of the liberties of the people involved in social life. And so that covers a lot of grounds. Often it's said that most American politics is liberal politics. What we call conservative politics is just a version of liberal, classical liberalism. What we consider, we can call liberal politics is a version of classical liberalism. The whole political spectrum is more or less liberal in the United States. But Kant is politically a moderate liberal, but liberalism was often associated with a pro-colonialist, pro-imperialist position. So John Stuart Mill, who was one of the great liberal theorists of the West, wrote the Treatise on Liberty, and his father, James Mill, were both employed by the British East India Company. They were, James Mill was an administrator in India, you know, the British colonial apparatus, and both argued that the colonized world had to be educated to the point where it could be given liberty. And so they justified Western colonialism as an educator mission. And that was not uncommon for liberals. And I would say it was not uncommon for liberals right down to the Vietnam War period. Now people think that the Vietnam War was the creation of John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson. You know, these were compared to Obama, these guys are on the far left. And yet they were,
Well, actually that was how General Lee justified his keeping slaves, that they weren't ready to be free.
Yeah, they weren't ready to be free, Right. Yeah, the liberal anti-colonialist or the liberal anti-imperialist is few and far between. So Kant is actually quite an interesting character in that respect.
I mean, suppose that you buy the argument that they're not ready to be free, that they say that they weren't also ready to be given basic human rights of like acts of civility, treat them with kindness, and stop maybe demonizing them?
Yeah, it depended. I would say that in general, people like Mill, like both James and John Stuart Mill, would have argued that a set of basic rights be accorded to everybody, including the colonized. Now, they should not be mistreated, they should not be be abused in certain ways, but they were not ready for self-rule.
Okay.
Right, yeah. There were others who were a little less kind about it, including people who considered themselves to be liberals. I remember there was one character in the history of British colonialism, I forget his name now. He was a contemporary of James Mill, and he was a liberal member of the British Parliament, but he argued basically that there wasn't, something very famous. He says, there isn't a, all of the written tradition of India is not worth a single volume from the European Library. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the civilization that wrote the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita. Whatever you say about India, there is a great literary tradition and a great philosophical tradition. But in any event, okay, the first definitive article of perpetual peace is that republic should spread across the globe. The second one is the critical. The second article where Kant lays out a sketch for an institutional structure, and it's just a sketch. There's no doubt about it. It's just a sketch. But what he says is that we need to do on the international level what we have done on the domestic level. Remember, for Kant, Kant's a social contract theorist. And for social contract theorists, life in the state of nature prior to the development of political institutions and laws is a state of the war of each against all. That's a Hobbesian expression. The war of each against everyone. Without laws, without a political apparatus, the only way that we can pursue our interests ultimately is through the application of force. And we're the only ones who are going to apply force on behalf of our own interests. But that creates the condition that Hobbes describes as one in which life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So we all have an interest in moving from that state of nature, the state of war, to a state of peace. And the social contract is what gets us from the state of nature to civil society, the state of peace. We agree to create a government and a legal apparatus that can mediate disputes peaceably.
and they can enforce laws. Hold on.
Kant says that when you do this domestically, you create a state of peace among the citizens of your own country, but now the relations between countries are still characterized by the state of nation. There's no international law, there's no international judicial body to settle disputes. There is simply the application of force, ultimately, in order to assert and protect one's own interests. In other words, nations are now in the same relation to one another that individuals were prior to the coming of the social contract. They are in a state of nature, which is a state of war. To say that it's a state of war doesn't mean that there have to be active hostilities all the time. What it means is that every nation is prepared to go to war. There's a threat of war, constant threat of war. It seems as though we should be able to replicate the process that got us from the state of domestic war to the state of domestic peace internationally. In other words, just as individuals enter into a social contract to put an end to the war between them as individuals, it seems as though nation states ought to be able to enter into a contract that would put an end to war among them as nation states. In the case of domestic society, the social contract creates a government that now has a monopoly of a legitimate means of force. Can the same thing happen internationally? Kant says no. This is the rub, right? This is the problem. I wouldn't say, can it happen internationally? But is it something that should be sought after? Is it something that we should want? And Kant says no. Kant opposes the idea of a world government. And the reason why, he's got a couple of reasons. First of all, he doesn't think that a world government would be able to hang together for very long. He thinks that it would ultimately degenerate into a condition of global anarchy. But the more interesting reason, I think, is the following. He says, and many people argue this way now who oppose global government, a global government would be too remote from the governed. In other words, right now we have trouble restricting the activities of our government in relation to public opinion. And how are we going to be able to control the activities of a global government? And it's going to be far more distant and alienated from the population than even the national governments are. Yeah.
Well, I get that ties in with my point. How do you even approach this issue of perpetual peace with so many people in the world? Because you have to be able to get your message out to the people, but if you're not approachable, then how are you supposed to maintain that perpetual peace if you can't completely control all your citizens and the citizens that are really
Well, no government controls all of its citizens, right. Obviously, right? You're still, the fact that we have a situation of domestic peace doesn't mean there isn't crime.
Right. Yeah.
But what it means is that there's an institutional structure to prevent that from becoming the norm. You know, and I think that Kant is thinking about something similar, but he doesn't think it can happen through the creation of an international state, of a global state. What then? A free federation of independent states. This is what Kant recommends. A free federation of independent states. Now, in such a federation, first of all, federation suggests that participation is voluntary, right? In such a federation, nation states would become members. In the act of pledging to submit their disputes with one another to an international judicial authority, no other powers would be given up. In other words, a federation is not a government that makes traffic laws for Massachusetts, right? It's not going to be a government that settles on tax policy for China. Every nation state maintains full sovereignty over its own affairs in a free federation, according to Kant. The only thing that participating nation states do is agree to submit their disputes to adjudication. So, in the same way that domestic law replaces the and domestic judges and the whole judicial apparatus, the whole legal apparatus, replaces my need to beat the hell out of you when I have a dispute with you. I can take you to court, right? In the same fashion, the development of international law and international judiciary would replace the need of nation states to beat the hell out of one another. Such a free federation, Kant says, is the only way in which it's conceivable to put an end to the threat of war. Now, both the League of Nations and the United Nations were attempts to do this. It's quite clear that both institutions were explicitly inspired by Kant's doctrine of perpetual peace. Now, we have to ask a hard question, and that is, why is it that neither of those institutions was able to put an end to war? Is it that they failed to realize Kant's dream, that they deviated from it? Or is it that Kant's dream doesn't work? Yeah.
Well, I think the question of sovereignty is a big point. If a lot of these nations, they'll maybe voluntarily become part of it, but they don't want to give other nations voluntary admittance into their sovereignty. For example, when if a country doesn't want to get weapons inspectors into their country, there's not much you can really do besides sanctions. If you're going to go to war, you have to, everybody else has to agree to do that, including them. So there's just a question of how much power you're willing to hand over to an international scale.
What about a situation in which only a fraction, or only, I wouldn't say a fraction, but less than all nation states are members of such a federation?
It seems like that what they decide would be just for everybody else who's not part of it, because they're the ones that are in it. It's so much as a rule of the minority rules, majority rights, instead of the other way around, I guess.
Unless such a federation included every nation state, it would seem to be more of a traditional alliance than a genuine federation for peace. Is it conceivable that every nation state could belong? Yeah.
But is it really a federation of superpowers?
Ah.
And opposing superpowers, that's something that we've not.
And Kant is clearly intending that all nations be equal in the international federation. Now, the UN embodies that principle in the General Assembly. And in the General Assembly, every nation state has an equal vote. But in the Security Council, of course, there are five permanent Security Council members.
Well,
it's World War II. Yeah, the victims. And it's a strange thing, because it's not even the five superpowers.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, France.
England. You know. Let's think about this. Jürgen Habermas is someone who has tried to refurbish perpetual peace and tried to refurbish Kant's program by recommending a series of, and Habermas is a German philosopher, probably one of the most important social philosophers of the current period. He has recommended a reform of UN structures and also the development of institutions outside of the UN in a way that he thinks would be practical and necessary for implementing Kant's vision of perpetual peace. So we're going to be reading Hobsbawm, Barbarism and the User's Guide, and Habermas's article, which is called A Constitution for a Pluralist World Society. Okay? So you want to start reading both of those. Get at least through Habermas, and we will discuss him on Friday, and then Hobsbawm next week. And then I want to get into surveillance, okay? So bring your video cameras and stuff like that.
Okay, that's it for today.